young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Call us toll free, 888-429-5471. Connie Thompson with us, currently a small business owner. She's been a teacher at Missouri State University, as well as a court reporter, a veterinary assistant, a real estate appraiser, a financial expert, an analyst, and a technical writer, and also a life coach. And most importantly, she's obtained through trial and error the OOPS Observer of People's Stupidity degree from HACC, Horse Apple College and University. And through all of her experiences, she's noticed men and women are different, no question about it. Some are taller, some are shorter. But men resemble horses more than anything else. Connie, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. How are you today?
Oh, I would whinny, but I'm afraid only a certain amount of people would understand it. I'm a horse guy from way back. I totally agree with you.
Well, it was a long story. I didn't have horses until I was older, and I wasn't very successful. You can tell by my track record and occupations that not only do I have dyslexia, but ADD. So I'm kind of all over the board, and it didn't work in relationships and until I ended up with 11 horses overnight, so you can imagine.
No, but when it comes to horses, what is it about horses that you related to?
Well, I didn't know anything about them, which was probably a very good thing. So yeah. I observed a lot. I stood back and watched and fed one end and scooped up the other end. And the more I stood out there looking at these horses, it occurred to me that you can't scream at a horse in a stall and get good reactions. You can't do the same thing to a man. You can't be inconsistent with a horse and get the result you want. You can't do the same thing with a man. And it dawned on me that even though biology tells us that we are the same species, men and women, we aren't. Men are genetically designed to do something different, just like horses are. And I think more women than not don't recognize that. And it's a lot easier if you can associate with a horse and say, these two are different, and then just laugh at the differences.
Okay, by the way, when it really comes down to it, there's a tremendous amount of differences. And I think one of the biggest problems, Connie, that people run into is when they look at somebody else, they see that somebody else through their eyes, and they can't distinguish that they think, they feel, they experience life any different than they do. And I think that's where the mistake happens. And I think you're absolutely right. Take a look at it in a different way. Take a look at the things that you learn, quote unquote, from the animal world. They're the greatest teachers that we have if we take the time and recognize what they have to offer.
Well, the interesting thing is that genetically, men are designed differently, and horses are too. Society treats us totally different. It teaches us totally different things that we're supposed to be when we grow up. Women can never be perfect enough, and we just kind of screw everything up rather than stand back and say, you know, horses are pretty magnificent creatures. So are men. Let's just appreciate the differences, laugh at the funny things, and enjoy them for the unique contribution they make to our lives. I think it's that simple, but we screw it up pretty quickly.
Now, where was that light bulb that came on for you? You watched the horses, you saw their behavior. Where was that correlation between horses and men and you?
Well, I started out, my father raised me, so I knew quite a bit about men, and I didn't learn all the feminine wiles until I got to college. So using those, I went through 3 failed marriages pretty quickly. And I was on number 4 going, I don't want this one to go the same way, but I don't know how to do anything differently. And the more I realized that if you go out and you watch a horse and you just kind of lean on it, you know, they lower your blood pressure, you can relax, and you can be real around a horse. women are not taught to be real too often around men. And so I started being a lot more real in my two-legged relationships. And it's been 20 years now, so I guess something's working.
Sure, why not? And by the way, when you say it the way you say it, obviously there are people who will back up and defense out and not want to look at it. But if you take the time and listen to you, I think what you've got really is spot on. There are tremendous differences between men and women. I really do believe that behavior between the two, if you and I, let's say, were brother and sister when we were brought up in the same family and we weren't treated any different between a boy and a girl, one of the things that men don't get, quote unquote, is youngsters, is the lap time that the girl will. There's an affection that's shown to some of the girls that are not shown to the boys. If you were to ask my sister and I, and we both love my mother very dearly, if you were to describe her, you get a completely different definition of my mom from me than you would from my sister. So I believe that we would have been brought up the same way, treated exactly the same way, and ran around with the same people and learned what we learned, I don't think there'd be too much difference between us. I think it's the way we're modeled, the way we're taught, more than anything else.
Well, I think so, too. And the sad part about women in our society is that we are taught how imperfect we are. All you have to do is walk through the supermarket magazine aisles, Walmart, anybody, and you find out that my hair's not the right color, it's not the right length, my makeup's not on correctly, my chest isn't big enough, my fanny is too big. I have to do all these things to strive for something that really has nothing to do with how to be happy in life. And I think that frequently women try so hard to be perfect and to be the perfect cook and the perfect mother and the perfect wife, they forget that life and relationships are supposed to be fun. That gets lost along the way. And, you know, my theory is that if you can put a horse in a halter, you can guide it to better results. If you put a man in a halter, you can do the same thing. But in my case, halter stands for a different thing than a leather strap around your head. But I think if people take the word halter, the H stands for humor and honesty. If you don't have that, you're suffering right off the bat. If you don't have A, admiration for the other person, you're suffering. If you don't have lust, and by that I don't mean jump on his bones all the time, but, you sure. know, it's the kind where you want to pat their fanny when you're walking down a grocery store aisle. If you don't have that, if you don't want to be near them and curl up with them, you're missing something. And then T stands for trust. My gosh, how many relationships survive without that? Yeah. E is for enthusiasm. If you're not enthusiastic about this person you're committed to, maybe you should find a horse or another fella. And if you don't respect them and they don't respect you, then you better just throw in the towel because it's not going to work. So I say put a man in a halter and he should put you in one. And you can, and I honestly believe that if you don't have all six of those things, you don't have the big four-letter word love. Yeah. It's that simple for me. And I try to tell people that. And fortunately, I think in my book I tell it in a funny way because women keep telling me they're laughing, which is a good thing because at least they're remembering that life is supposed to be fun. But anyway, I'm pretty happy with the results of my own relationship, so I'm trying to get other people to rethink theirs. So how am I doing? Are you rethinking?
No, by the way, I think you're doing a phenomenal job. And I think if you go right down to the base of it, that's really what it's all about. And people don't think about that when they begin a relationship. And by the time the trouble starts, usually it's too late. The relationship's over. They've been married 2, 3, 4 times. And just like you were saying, back to square one, what do I do now? And I don't want this one to be like that. But it's most people getting that practical look at it, that practical, this is what it's going to take to get the job done. And I think in the end result, if two people are attracted to each other, if the chemistry is there, the result is all they want is what you're talking about.
Well, yeah, I mean, the end result of love is companionship and someone whose hand you can hold and laugh at life with. And I think that in our society, women are taught wrong. One of the things I tell my husband all the time is when I get romantic and he blows it with a line like, "Where's the remote control?" I tell him, you don't know your lines. you didn't read the romance novels I read, so you don't know your lines, and we just laugh about it.
Yeah.
You know, but what else can you do?
But
he also has what I call, you know, men are notoriously guilty of having refrigerator blindness. My husband can look in a refrigerator and not find the butter if there was nothing in there but the butter. I mean, you have to stand back and just go, isn't that hilarious? And rather than women get angry and expectations are so high, that they just don't sit back on their haunches and go, isn't he a hoot? He may be a mess, but he's mine, and isn't he cute, you know? So,
sure.
We're too serious. We're much too serious, I think.
Yeah, and I think when it comes down to it, you're right. Get rid of the seriousness. Somebody smiles at you, and you don't even know what's behind the smile. But based on your own personal experience, if it's not something nice, you're going to attack them. And all they did was smile at you. So you're right. It's taking that little bit of time and laughing at it and not taking it all serious. You take it all serious, that's where most of the problems start.
Well, it's funny. If you talk to a group of women, you find out that all of their men do essentially the same things. And I'm sure all of their wives do essentially the same things, too. And I have sat with women who sit back and say, really? Other men do that, too? That's not just my husband? And I go, no, they're kind of genetically designed to have selective hearing when they want it, you know, and the refrigerator blindness. And selective amnesia sometimes because, you know, it's just the way they are and they're funny about it. But I think that from what I have witnessed and what I've seen of the women around, most of them are just too serious. And I think it's the way they're trained. I don't think anybody takes young girls aside and said, let me tell you something. Laugh lines are sexy.
Yeah.
Honesty is sexy. You have those two things, and you don't need all that other stuff that the magazines keep dumping on you. So if you can look at a man and say, this is a species, unlike me, it's more like my horse. There are times, you know, my horse does not do chest bumps in bars, but other than that, there's a lot of similarities. Men are more relaxed. They're more comfortable in their skin. You don't see men standing back going, oh, my God, I've got circles under my eyes. Where's the highlighter? You know, and I think they're much more natural beasts like horses are. I think we should strive to be more like them.
You know, I just...
That's my two cents.
I had this thought. I had this vision. This is what I'm going to do. The next time I meet a woman and I get attracted and I fall in love, if I start feeling that way, I'm going to go out and get a saddle. And I'm going to walk up and say, you see what this is for? And if you don't know, we don't have any grounds for a relationship.
Well, that's why. But if she slaps a halter on you, you better be ready.
You bet. Then I'll know she's heard the show. Connie, we're running out of time.
Yeah, maybe she'll take it in a good way, and so will you.
There you go. Is there a website we can find you at?
Yes, www.conniekthompson.com. And
wonderful.
I have a blog on there and the books on there, and you can see that I do like to laugh in life. I think I can find funny things in almost every situation. So if you're not laughing, I don't think you're living.
I got that one loud and clear. Hey, by the way, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, well, thank you, Michael. I appreciate your time. Have a good evening.
You too. Good night.
Good night. And what road is so wide, stay there. There are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are
are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
All my good wishes go with you tonight.
Call us at 1-888-429-5471 and join us anytime you want. Barbara Berger with us is the author of The Awakening Human Being, A Guide to the Power of the Mind. She's an American-born, best-selling author of The Road to Power, Fast Food for the Soul, published in 30 languages. She's also the author of Are You Happy Now? 10 Ways to Live a Happy Life, and also The 10 Mental Laws, Mental Technology, Gateway to Grace, the Spiritual Pathway. And let's say, Barbara, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for inviting me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. How is the weather in Denmark? What time is it there?
It's 1 o'clock in the morning, and it's cold and snowy.
Oh, no. Okay, but at least you're inside all wrapped up so we can talk.
Yes, yes, I am.
Okay. All right, let me ask you this. We talk about the mind. The mind's a very interesting thing, and there's more and more information coming out about it. And most of life as we know it today is based on a choice. But there are choices that we don't know that we have. And I really believe people like yourself who get into this and begin to explore and get into those unknown horizons that the mind and all those choices that the mind has to offer open doorways for us. And the average person, how much about the mind does the average person truly really know?
That's the reason why I write all these books, because I've discovered that most people are really unaware of the incredible power of their mind. So this information, the information that's in my books that you're talking about, is so life-transforming, is so self-empowering. But unfortunately, most people don't know this stuff, so they are actually, you could say, innocent victims of the way their minds work, because they don't really understand how their minds work.
Okay, let's take you back when you first got your moment of discovery, quote-unquote. What is it about the mind that you discovered that we could put to practical use?
Well, I think the most important thing to understand, and this is what I found out, of course, is that we never really experience reality directly. We only experience our stories, or you could say our interpretation of the events that are unfolding before us. And usually we're so identified with our thinking, our stories, that we don't realize that the event has not got the same meaning as we are putting into it. And so we are somehow victims of forces that we don't really understand. But when we see that there's actually a difference between our thinking and events, our thinking and reality, then we suddenly have a choice. We can look at our thinking and we can ask ourselves, well, is this a sane, productive way to regard the situation? Or maybe I should look at things in a different way. So we gain flexibility, we gain a new freedom, we gain power to take control of our lives. So it's a very, very important issue for all of us.
Well, let's put it in two different ways. Let's say, for instance, that I was brought up in a way that I experienced that love is pain. And if I meet
what
somebody...
What did you experience?
Okay, what if I was brought up, hypothetically now, I wasn't, but let's say I was brought up to believe that love was pain. You fall in love, they're going to beat you up, or they're going to walk out on you.
Yeah, so exactly. Now that's a great... Yeah,
yeah, and
great
I've got this
story.
Sure, and I've got this reality going that if I fall in love, there's pain. Well, I'm living in a world, in my mind, that really doesn't exist for that person that I meet. And that, in and of itself, can put me at the mercy of my past experience in life. One
Absolutely.
More thing before I want to finish this statement. It was Carl Jung who said it, that he said, most of us mistake reality for assumptions. An assumption
exactly.
may have an incontestable conclusion. So you take it on as a reality, and you're living your life based on assumptions that has nothing to do with the current event, and you get into a lot of trouble.
A lot of trouble. I totally agree. I usually tell the story, let's just take a concrete example, another
sure.
one similar to what you're saying. Say, let's take divorce, right? That's something that's a big issue for many people. If you look at what the reality of a divorce is, it's actually, the reality is two people who live together, they've now separated. That's what a divorce is. And for one person, they have the story that divorce is, you know, the end of the world, I'll never find anybody again, I'll always be alone, I'll never have love again. And so they go into deep depression. Another person gets divorced and it's like, hallelujah, finally I'm free, I got rid of the guy, you know. So, but the divorce itself, the reality of the divorce is still two people who live together are now separated. So you really don't experience just the event, you experience your interpretation of the event. So that's the incredible power of the mind. And so you could say that, okay, in the divorce situation, if you have this very catastrophic interpretation of a divorce, maybe it's not serving you so well. Maybe you want to question your story. Is it true that I'll never experience love again? Is it true that I'll be alone for the rest of my life? Is it true? And you start to see that maybe your thinking is not so productive for the life you want to live.
Okay, but you have to realize that there are, not you in the general sense of the word, and this is what you've done. You've got to realize that there are, quote-unquote, alternatives, roadmaps to get to particular places. Let's call something a law, you know, that a rule to follow. And if you follow the rules, if you understand the way, the dynamic, the way that the mind works, then you can work with it.
Well, that's exactly why I wrote this book, exactly what you're saying. My book is called The Guide to the Power of Mind. And actually, the whole first section of the book is what I call the mental laws. Because I found out that the way the mind works is an impersonal mechanism that we can all study and learn. And in fact, I'd like to tell our listeners that if you're interested in these mental laws, you can download them for free on my website, www.beamteam.com. I have tried to map out the way the mind works, and I call it the mental laws. And I try to show that it's an impersonal mechanism that's something that's affecting all of us. But because we're not aware of it, we're kind of victims of this. But if we learn about it, then we can actually use it to benefit ourselves. So these mental laws that I describe, and which you can download on my website, they are impersonal mechanisms like physical laws, like the law of gravity, any kind of law that affects all of us. You could say, for example, that the law of gravity, it affects all people whether or not we're aware of the fact that there's a law of gravity. I mean, if you stand on top of a building and you jump off, you're going to fall down whether or not you know the law of gravity exists. And it's the same with the mental laws. It's the same with the way the mind works. So I think the fact that so many of us are starting to wake up to this information is so exciting, because that means big change is going to happen for a lot of people.
Well, I think one of the things we're dealing with also, if people say, I can't find happiness, I want to be happy, and you know the list goes on and on. But if you don't think that you have the ability and the power and the wherewithal to create happiness, just look at the other side of it and look what you've done to yourself, you know, with the pain and the rest of it that goes along with it. So what I'm really hearing you say, it's a shift of thinking. Anything that happens in my life me personally, I'm responsible for it based on how I saw it in the past, based on the emotional connection unconsciously that I may have toward a particular subject that's going to cause me to react in a particular way. So what I'm hearing you say, it's changeable if you follow the law.
Yeah, it's changeable. You first of all have to become aware of what's going on. And when you become aware, you actually start to have options. It's exactly as you said. You start to be able to see that there is actually a difference between reality and your thinking. I mean, that's really a key point. When you can suddenly see that, because you can see it, you suddenly realize you have options. You suddenly realize that the value of events is not something that's inherent in the event itself. It's actually something that you superimpose upon it. So that if you are unhappy, you might want to question, is this really true? Is this unhappiness really inherent in what's going on? Or are there other options for me here? So that's very self-empowering. I mean, I work as a therapist, so I see what this awareness does for people. It's like suddenly, wow. You know, suddenly it's like, you mean I can actually do something about this situation? So it's,
And I have found, which I thought was kind of interesting, somebody gave me a great example of this year, probably 35 years ago, actually, which was a great example about unconsciously activating an emotion and reacting to it, good or bad, at that moment, that you're reacting to what's going on in front of you at this time. It's something that might have happened a week ago, 10 years ago, 50 years ago. Okay, you're still going through it. And what they said was the prime example would be driving down the highway of life with your hands on the rear view mirror steering your life. You get into a tremendous amount of accidents. But if you take a simple shift in the way you think and you put your hands on the steering wheel, that simple shift all of a sudden brings you into today, and you're not at the effect of yourself.
It's a great story. Great story. Yeah, so it's so exciting to actually to get to work with these. I mean, also personally, what it's done for my own life, and then sharing this information with other people and seeing how other people really turn their lives around. It's just so wonderful. And actually, what I'm hoping is going to happen soon is that we're going to start to teach this stuff to kids in school. I mean, we didn't learn this in school, so it's taken us our whole lives to figure it out, but now there's more and more people who are starting to understand this stuff, so it's something that we can soon start teaching our children on a regular basis. This will be so wonderful.
Yeah, there was a great story. My sister and I got into an argument, I don't know, a couple of years ago, whatever the case may be. It was one of those rip-roaring I hate you times, right? And I can't remember what it was, but I called her something. It wasn't a four-letter expletive. I said something like, you know, you're dependent. And then she looked at me and she said, you're a loser, okay? And then those weren't the words, but I can't remember, but they were like that. And I walked out of the room and I stopped and I started smiling. And I popped my head back in the door and I said, you know what just happened? She said, what? What I think about me, I called you. And what you think about me, you just called me. Yeah. And we both started laughing because that was the reality of it.
When
people get upset because somebody doesn't like me, somebody offended me, etc., if we really get that they're not offending you, they're offending themselves, and you get to be used to do so, we don't do anything about anybody else. It's all a reflection of ourselves.
Always. Yeah, that's also one of those great realizations when you get that. Yeah. I mean, I think the other thing is also, I mean, when you start looking at stuff like this, you can also say that when you start to understand these mechanisms, you can ask yourself, what is actually preventing you from being happy right now? Considering that everybody wants to be happy, that's sort of like our primary drive in life. If you really stop people up and say, well, what is actually preventing you from being happy right now? And it's like people that go, but when you actually ask people, it's always a story they have about something in the past or something in the future. It's never really anything that's going on in this moment. And that's also similar to what you're talking about. It's all these projections, either forward, backwards to other people, instead of resting at home with themselves and finding out that this moment is actually quite okay. So it's, again, this getting lost in the story, getting lost in your mind, and not really noticing that, you know, this moment is quite okay and everything is quite fine right now.
Yeah, and then we get into the, you know, we're starting to run out of time, but if we get into the okay. If only I had money, if only I had a relationship, if only I had this. And I think a great example of that is look at some of the Whitney Houston, who just, you know, who just passed away. What a waste.
Yeah,
what a,
I know.
Whatever. You know, and you get people, the Michael Jacksons, the rest of them, they're making millions and billions of dollars,
right,
yet there's something missing, whatever that is, that causes them for the rehab, et cetera. So it's not if I only had money or if I only had this. It's called look in the mirror if you only had yourself.
Mm-hmm. Well, what you're really talking about also is that we live in a society, in a culture where we seem to have been programmed that our happiness depends on all these outer things. I mean, on money, as you say, and if you have the right husband or the right wife, if you have what a nice car you have, what a great job you have. I mean, and not that there's anything wrong with any of these things, but that they're all outer circumstances which change, which you can't control, which come and go, which, you know, sooner or later you're going to lose. So the true happiness, the happiness that's always there, that's unconditional, is actually the joy of life itself, which is what you are to begin with. So in a way, you could say we're seeking happiness in all the wrong places, too. But that's also the mind taking us in all these directions and all these stories that we're not questioning.
But that's the whole point, Barbara. I want to make sure we get this point. That's the whole point. It's, you were talking about the stories we tell each other, or we tell to ourselves. That's what you're dealing with those kids that become famous and can't deal with the fame, quote unquote.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're starting to run out of time. Barbara Berger, do you have a website we can find you at, buy the books, and follow you?
Yes, the website is www.beamteam, B-E-A-M-T-E.
Some of these days, you'll feel so lonely. You're gonna miss my hugging, you miss my kissing.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
When I'm gone away, you're gonna feel lonely.
Call us toll-free anytime during the show, 888-429-5471. That's 888-429-5471. Mark Begel with us. He's the author and biographer of the Superstars. He's the author of 50 published books on rock and roll and show business. And his latest book is Whitney Houston, The Tragic Rise of a Spectacular Fall of the Woman Whose Voice Inspired a Generation. Mark, hi. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Oh, by the way, thank you so much for being here. You know, we've heard so much about Whitney Houston, and, you know, obviously I can't imagine anybody who didn't love what she did. But if you really looked at Whitney Houston, if you really looked at the woman, the person, beyond what we see, what did you see through your eyes?
Well, I have a really unique perspective on Whitney's career. In the 70s, I was the nightlife editor of Q magazine, C-U-E, which was a guide to what's going on in Manhattan. And I used to review cabaret acts and jazz acts and what have you. And I went to see Sissy Houston at a cabaret in New York City. And in the middle of her act, she introduced her teenage daughter, who was singing background for her. She said, "This is my daughter, Whitney, and she plans to be a singer one day." And she proceeded to demonstrate that she already was quite an accomplished singer. I followed her career. I went to Arista Records by invitation only events where Whitney was showcased. I was at her 1985 Carnegie Hall debut, and I followed her career very closely, all the way up the ladder to absolute superstardom. And I also witnessed her at several occasions when she was back on her way back down the ladder and starting to have some problems. So I really feel like I'm someone who has a unique perspective on Whitney Houston. I wrote the very first book about her in 1986, and this is an updated version of the book I did in 2009 for the German language market. So when she passed away, I very quickly brought the book full circle, and that's the book that's hit the bookstores this week.
And by the way, the biographies that you've done, just some of the women, Madonna, Cher, Tina Turner, Julia Roberts, but let's go back to the singers, the Cher's, the Tina Turner's, the Madonna's, Patsy Cline, let's talk about also country western. did you feel, did you experience a familiar pattern with them? Was there something, some kind of an overarching theme that was the same with all of them? And then what was it that caused Whitney Houston to stand out from the others?
Well, I think there are certain patterns of women who really strive to accomplish things in the music business. There obviously is a natural talent that comes along with it, but there's also a drive to achieve and a drive to become a glamorous star in the eyes of the public. And very often it's instilled in them from their families, like it was from Whitney Houston. I mean, Whitney Houston grew up in such a famous family. To have Dionne Warwick as your cousin, to have Whitney or Sissy Houston as your mother, and watch your mother sing background in the recording studio with Elvis Presley, with Aretha Franklin, with so many superstars. I mean, the pattern was really there. So she got to see what show business was like right really up front. With someone like Cher, she got to see what was going on in the record business by dating a guy named Sonny Bono and going into the studios with Phil Spector and singing background on other people's songs. Bette Midler in Hawaii grew up longing to come to New York City and make something of herself and become a Broadway star, and she became really her own invention. Patsy Cline grew up in the mountains of, Virginia area, longing to sing and having that incredible, powerful voice. So the voice is definitely something that is crucial. And then a drive to take that talent and show the public what you're all about is definitely a theme. As far as the tragic nature of Whitney, I mean, that's another sort of formula that's in the mix.
Yeah, and I was going to bring that up. But, you know, you look at Tina Turner, that was abused there with Whitney Houston. Bobby Brown couldn't have been the greatest husband at all. And with the talent, the tremendous insights that these women have, why would they choose, not that this is a question that we actually know, but why would they choose the bad boy, quote unquote? Why would they choose that one person that would cause misery in their life?
It's really kind of amazing, that's one of the mysteries that I try and solve in this book, is what drew her to someone like him. She had such a church background, such a strong family behind her. She had an image that was carefully planned by Clive Davis, the record company president at Arista, who gave her such a classy setting in the 80s when she debuted, making sure that she was the good girl next door, the lovely girl who was singing in the church when you were growing up, who's become a glamorous superstar, cover girl, movie star. And to take that and everything that she was handed and everything that she mastered, it's really kind of a mystery why she sought someone out like Bobby Brown. It's easy to point a finger and say Whitney Houston's downfall is caused by Bobby Brown. Well, I mean, she could have gotten away from that relationship at any point. It was one that she chose. She certainly was the breadwinner in the family. His career was kind of cooling down when they were married. And it's odd to find out that I think she had something in her that was an insecurity, and she wanted to escape into, someone else who had insecurities as well. And it was really just a bad mixture, the two of them.
No, absolutely.
It's so sad for all of us to see.
Sure. And Mark, when you deal with it, Bobby Brown, whatever Bobby Brown was, is, or will be, it wasn't him, and you hit it. It was Whitney through him that allowed her to be able to do this. Had she been with somebody else, she really wouldn't have been able to express herself the way she did and go on, you know, off in the tangents and the drinking and so on and so forth. So we do nothing more than use people to be able to say, well, if it wasn't for him or her, we wouldn't have done this. And so you're
exactly
right. I think it's something. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was going to say exactly. In relationships, especially these female singers, they choose the relationships that they feel work for them. She certainly could have called the shots and divorced him, you know, the first year of their marriage. And she chose to stick with him. And I don't know how she got in this cycle. And it is really kind of a downward spiral that some people in show business find themselves. I mean, we would think that we watch Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones. We're amazed that he's still alive. My God, you know. And Whitney Houston is someone who, you know, we see as a frail butterfly who really just kind of, you know, flew too close to the flames and went back to the flames time and time again. It's really upsetting to see. And you know, I think that when I think you probably, as well as I, saw, you know, her demise in the last month, and my first impression was, oh my God, how could that have happened? And then my second thought was, I'm surprised it took so long. She was on really a path of self-destruction, and it's so sad. She had so many chances. And I have to really salute Clive Davis. He really gave her a lot of chances. That album that she did in 2009, I Look to You, she really had a classy setting. She had the record company behind her. She had fans all over the world who wanted to see her sing, wanted to see her back on top. And she got so mired into drugs, and that tour was just a debacle and really just kind of ruined her bankability as a concert artist. And it made the whole world witness the fact that she had eroded her voice to the point where she couldn't even sing her biggest hit songs live.
Oh, you know, I remember something very similar to that, and I remember it as if I was sitting here right now. When right before Judy Garland passed away, Judy Garland had lost her voice. They did a television hour dedicated to Garland, and she sang to the audience, and she sat on the stage, and she did everything that she could do. But her voice was raspy, and I don't think anybody heard that raspy voice. All they heard was Judy Garland. So there was a something. Look at Robin Williams, as a matter of fact. Who would think that he would be in and out of in and out of rehab? So there is something that goes along with it, that when we look at people and say they have all of this, why? There's more. There's much more to that than most people could grasp or put their arms around. You've got extremely sensitive people. If they did not have, Mark, if they didn't have that sensitivity, they couldn't be and do what they do. They couldn't.
Exactly. Yes. I totally agree. They couldn't portray those emotions in songs that touch us as well as they do. You're absolutely right. There is a frailty and sort of a delicateness to their lives that makes them draw us to them, want to hear their songs. One of the parallels, I mean, that is absolutely brilliant. Judy Garland is a perfect parallel. And another one I make in this book is Billie Holiday. I mean, we all think of Billie Holiday as singing those fabulous jazz songs with a gardenia pinned to the side of her hair in a smoky jazz club. And then we unfortunately have to remember that she too eroded her life and her voice and died in her 40s. So we've got Judy Garland with that pattern, dying in her 40s, Billie Holiday passing away in her 40s, and now Whitney Houston. And it's sort of sad that Whitney didn't learn from the paths that these other women went down and that brought them down.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there was another one also, Natalie Cole. Natalie, absolutely
yes.
Gorgeous. A wonderful voice. My goodness, she was just as good as her father was and went down that same path.
Yes, I actually, it's funny you should mention her. 2 days ago, I was at a party with Natalie Cole here in Hollywood, Mary Wilson of the Supremes. It was her birthday party, and Natalie came. And what's so wonderful about Natalie is that at a certain point, she recognized that she did have a problem and sought help. And I think that that's what we all hoped that Whitney Houston would do, that one day the light would come on and she'd go, oh, my God, this is crazy. I've got to get out of this lifestyle.
No, absolutely. And it's too bad that it didn't happen. And maybe, just some of these youngsters may take a look at this and anticipate what could happen before it happens. And the other side of that, maybe in their own way, the way they garner attention is to, if you've got everything you could possibly do and you don't think you could do anymore, if you die at that moment, the legacy of who you were up to that point will stay forever. And maybe for her, just maybe, Mark, maybe for her, she didn't think she was going any farther. And if she really wanted to save whatever was left, it was time to leave.
Possibly. You know, it's kind of like the Elvis Presley syndrome, too.
Yeah.
You know, Elvis could have gone on and on and was surrounded by enablers. And this is one of the points that I make in the book, too, is there were so many people enabling Whitney to continue this way. I was shocked to see some of the interviews of the day after she died, the people that were with her the last 48 hours of her life. Oh, she was just having champagne and having fun. No, she wasn't. you're covering up for her. You're enabling her to destroy her life for whatever reason. You want to stand in, you know, on the side of her spotlight and be part of the party, but you're not helping her at all. And it's just a sad, sad thing. So when I put this book together, it really celebrates the wonderful music and wonderful movies that Whitney has left as her legacy, but it also is kind of a cautionary tale as to look what can happen when you fly too high.
No, absolutely. And The Bodyguard will be, she was the movie. It didn't matter who else was in that movie. She was that movie. And I don't know if anybody will ever be able to recapture the kind of voice this woman had. I mean, it's just that it's something that will last forever. The power in that voice still is unbelievable.
Just amazing. Just amazing. And that is a movie that was around, you know, kicked around Hollywood as an idea for ages. It was actually a film that Steve McQueen was going to star in. When he died of cancer, it was talked about that it was going to be Ryan O'Neal as the bodyguard and Diana Ross as the singer. But they never got the money together. And when Kevin Costner found this script that was still unproduced, he realized that Whitney Houston was the person who should portray the lead in this movie. And she will always remember her. If she had but one movie role, that is the movie role. Of course, she made, Waiting to Exhale and Preacher's Wife, which were very entertaining as well. But Bodyguard, you're absolutely right, is just a classic, and we'll always remember her that way.
And that was Whitney Houston. Maybe not necessarily the real Whitney Houston, but the talent and the voice and some of the fears and the you mentioned enablers. That's what she had around her in the movie.
Exactly, exactly. So here was a movie she starred in that we all absolutely love, and in a way, it depicted someone else who was victim of their own fame as well. It's like she ignored all these telltale signs, the Judy Garland story, the Billie Holiday story, and even the fictional story she played in The Bodyguard. It's really an amazing show business story. And you know, we have seen so many people, or so many ladies come in and out of the business who have one or two hits, and their career doesn't go on. Here it is 25 years later after her debut. We still longed for more classic songs and more great albums from Whitney Houston. And she had a career that really endured a lot of decades, a lot of changes in the music business. And it's such a shame to have witnessed this. And I think that's why the world really is still in mourning for her and in shock that she's suddenly gone.
You know, it was interesting. I remember when Michael Jackson was killed. I remember the day that John F. Kennedy was killed. I remember exactly what happened. I was working. My mom called me, and she said, the president just got, you know, mowed down and whatever. But And obviously, you know, I paid attention to it. But when the news hit, and I've always got the news on behind me, obviously, but when the news hit and it said, you know, Whitney Houston dead, it kind of backed me up, you know, as if I knew her. And I don't know her, obviously, or didn't. But she was so familiar that who didn't know her?
Absolutely, absolutely. And one of the wonderful things that's happened, well, for me, is that be able to get this book out and to see how many people around the world want to read this story. This is going to be my first book that is going to be translated into Chinese for China. I mean, that's how global her fame was. I have a British book deal. I have a French-Canadian book deal. My agent is making book deals around the world. And I'm not saying this to pat myself on the back. I'm actually amazed that people around the world want to know this story and want more of Whitney Houston.
And that's the interesting thing about music and vibration. You do not have to understand the words to experience the power of the music and the feeling of the music. I have felt for many years now that when you're touched by music, your entire world turns around. I think it's a chemical change in the body, and it doesn't matter what the language is. It's the way the way it's put out and the way that it's received. And that's why she was global. You didn't have to understand English to actually fully appreciate Whitney Houston.
Absolutely. I totally agree. You and I can listen to Edith Piaf and get the same feeling whether we speak French or not. It transcends the language barriers. It absolutely does. And when I was working on the updates, I mean, obviously very quickly since her passing, I was able to get this book out within 3 weeks of her death. It caused me to go back and listen to those first three albums. And I had actually, it had been a while since I got those CDs out and put them on my stereo and listened to that clean, clear, pure voice that she had, especially on that debut album. I mean, what an amazing voice. And you're absolutely right. It wouldn't have mattered if she was singing in Lithuanian. We'd have still been absorbed by the magic of her voice.
Oh, absolutely. Mark, we're starting to run out of time now. Let me ask you this. Website we can find you at, follow what you're doing, and also buy the books.
Thank you so much. It's www.markbego.com, and there's a list of all my 58 books that are there. And actually, I have a book coming out on Aretha Franklin later this month, just in time for her 70th birthday.
Wonderful.
Someone actually related to Whitney Houston.
We'd love to have you back on. Mark, thank you so much for being with us. I've appreciated your time, and nice job. Nice job.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all. That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
A dream lover will come my way, a girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charms. Because I'll
welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Call us toll free 888-429-5471. Vibin Mata with us. He is the author of a book series, Global Healing: Thinking Outside the Box, Awakening Spirituality, and New Vistas of Hope. He's an engineer by profession, a metaphysical educator, and an author of a series of books, again, called Global Healing. He was born and raised in Mumbai, India, during the era of Mahatma Gandhi, and was inspired by his principles of nonviolence. Came to America in 1969, where he became a licensed professional engineer and established Mata Engineering, and he pursued metaphysical and spiritual learning by spiritual masters and mystics all over the world. Vipin, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, we hear about spirituality, and there are so many disciplines, but what I've learned in a lifetime of learning and watching, whether it's Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, whatever the case may be, Zen, Christianity, Judaism, At bass, there is that undefined special something that connects everybody. And most people get lost because they don't know how to look for it, or they don't know how to recognize it when it's there. How do you do that? What's the first path? What's the first step to recognizing your own spirituality or your own soul purpose?
Okay. When you mention Hinduism, Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, they are organized religions. Now, we have to separate between spirituality and organized religion. Spirituality, by definition, is my relationship with the divinity or God, goddess, all that is. In Western world, we use the God, and Eastern world, we use God, goddess, and we combine together, call God, goddess, all that is. So you have every individual relationship. It can be negative relationship, it can be positive relationship. So sometimes it is a very informal relationship. We converts into partnership, and it becomes deeper and deeper relationship, turns into partnership, and then finally it gets the union, divine union. There is spirituality, where organized religion is based on the belief systems. I have a Hindu belief system, Christian is a Bible belief system, Judaism is the Torah belief system, Buddhism is the Dhammapada belief system. The belief systems are there, but they're down. For some time, beliefs are good until we are really willing to receive from other beliefs, understand the other belief system. Also, that becomes, it requires the courage, and that courage is to become a seeker. When you are confined with the one belief system, you narrow down and your consciousness is limited. The spirituality is nothing but expansion of consciousness. So you can understand the one belief system, other belief system, but that is not your experience. The experience is different than belief. I believe, but if I don't have anything, when you use the word belief, that's what you don't have experience of it. Once you have experience, you don't use the word belief. Sun rises in the morning. I cannot say I believe the sun rises because I have experienced sun rises in the morning. So that belief system, wait, you have any question?
Oh, I was going to say, what I'm hearing you say, and stop me if I'm wrong, you what we're dealing is with beyond definition, beyond limitations, beyond beyond those things that we are taught. There's a word I want to use. It'll come. If I remember it at 4 o'clock in the morning, I'll call you. But a discipline, that's the word I wanted. It goes beyond discipline. I think the biggest fear that most people have is to step outside their belief system, because for the most part, they have been taught if you step outside, there is a penalty to pay. There, I think, is where the problem is. Getting that union you're talking about is having the guts, quote unquote, is to step outside what you've learned and walk into what is there to learn.
Okay, let me give an example. When child is born, his slate is clean, and the parents write in the slate, go to the school. School people teaches writing in the slate, and then the organized religion write in the slate. The political system writes, and he prepares all the life script is prepared during child, adolescent to the young adult. Then he becomes a young adult, then he is of choice. Because now he's like a Hollywood actor. The script is written by somebody else, and he's become a performer. So when you become young, you have a power of choice. Then you rewrite your own, script, you become author of your own script, and then you become performer. So you are author and the performer together. Here is the belief systems are instilled from childhood to the young adult to teenager years. But if you allow other people to write the belief system, then you don't have power of choice, and then you confine. Then you become fearful. Then you become fearful to go outside the belief system. Okay? So when I've written three books, one is the thinking outside the box. That you break the belief system. And then you are willing to go, these are all written in Bible or Gita or Quran or the Torah. Are maybe right, may not be right. But it is not my experience. Then you become a seeker. Then you start looking. I'm not neglecting what is written in the Bible or the Quran or Gita or Torah and Dhammapada or Jain Vani or other scriptures. I do study. But that's not my experience. I become a seeker, and when I get experience, then I come from what is written in the Bible, Torah, or the Gita. That you have to. That requires the courage to seek. Like a scientist goes in the physical reality. Scientist goes in the laboratory, goes with the he doesn't go with the preconditioned biases of mind. You make an experiment, observe it, then notes the answer. Then he makes further progress. The seeker is also inner scientist, is the inner world. When he starts looking, seeking, what is real and what is not real, and what is he getting experience. Okay.
I think that's where we both said the exact same thing. We said it in a different way. You talked about it as a life script, and you're saying step outside that life script and then begin to really learn. I'm saying if you step outside your definition, your limitations, your discipline, that in and of itself is your life script. People are frightened to death to step out. They're afraid to take that first step, and they live their lives limited based on other people's expectations of what their life should be like, whether it be a relationship, whether it be a church, a mosque, or whatever. And when it really comes down to it, it is doing what you're talking about doing, allowing yourself to know that there's more out there than what you've been offered so far. And I think that's the magic. When you take that step, when you're willing to do that, I think the world opens up, and the possibility of learning and growing and healing are unlimited.
I do 100% agree, but we have to be willing to go out, think outside the box, break of current belief system, and think, look for the other areas also. You've got a big spectrum. You have more possibility, more choices, more probabilities to create reality.
Yeah, oh, okay, but
awakening spirituality.
Yeah, but let's touch on something that that's in your press release. When we talk about globally, the problems that are going on globally, there's war, there's killing, there's so on and so forth. And this is a prime example of the fear of stepping out of the life script, the belief system. There are people who are controlled. They are told to do certain things, and if they don't do those certain things, their life is over, or they're going to, God will not like you, or you're going to go to hell, or you're going to do something. So there's set up parameters of what they can't do, and they're told not to think for themselves. There's where the problem is. It's allowing people think for themselves.
Now, that was, we created a problem because we gave a power to organize religion. We gave a power to the politician who make the decisions. We gave power to economic leaders, political leaders, military leaders, economic leaders, and religious leaders. And they are the ones that make the decision for us. So we have to take back the power back. And we have to select such a people so they can listen. We have to be actively involved in getting the power back. The moment you give power to somebody, then they dictate your life. So we have to take power back. Power lies within you. That is awakening of spirituality. Your power lies within you. But we allow them to. There we have two causes. When you cause it, and there is the effect. There is another way you allow it, then there is the effect. Now we are allowing. They abuse the system. And there is a part of them. They create the domination.
And by the way, I found what I wanted to find in your press release. The Global Hearing Series is a timely reminder that war, conflict, violence is all rooted in the human mindset. That's really what it is. It's called
most of the people, they check with the physical form, and they use the diplomacy and the treaty and everything, but they are doing it the physical. But the root cause lies in state of mind. And the state of mind, how to change the state of mind, that's where the metaphysics, knowledge of metaphysics comes. Because metaphysics is beyond, meta word means beyond, and physics is anything within space-time dimension. The brain is part of the space-time dimension, while the mind, imagination, creativity is beyond space-time dimension. You cannot put in space-time dimension. Soul, spirit, divinity, they're beyond space-time dimension. That knowledge, because we have been educated throughout the lifetime by logic and reason, and then we created intellectual knowledge, and then we become intelligence, and we have a CIA and everything. But they cannot solve the problem because root cause lies in state of mind. Now, you already mentioned in the beginning that the belief systems are conflicting each other. Islamic belief system conflict with Christian versus the Hindu, and that we create a world of religious belief, the political system conflict with capitalism and socialism and communist system, and that creates haves and gaps between haves and have-not, and helpful being help and helpless, and hopeful and hopeless. The four gaps we create, and one side is a fanatism, and the other side is rational. The four major gaps are increasing, and they try to solve like a physician trying to heal the cancer by removing the symptoms by chemotherapy and radiotherapy, but they cannot remove the, they cannot find the root cause lies. The root cause doesn't lie in state of physical body, right, somewhere else in the state of mind, like a blood pressure, or right, we have a blood pressure or the diabetes. Root cause lies in the state of mind. So we give our diabetic tablets and all those things to remove the symptoms, but they cannot approach to the root cause. Our root cause of all conflicts is hidden. In 20th century, we lived in two periods. One is preparation for war, and second is the war itself. And we, yeah, every time we are going exponentially, growing higher. First World War, then Second World War. Now we are heading in Cold War, and third one, then we call war on terrorism. And now every day on TV, they are thinking of atomic war from Iran and non-Iran, and other people are going out there.
Yeah, but Bob, isn't it not so much the war, isn't it creating fear? You create the fear, you can control the population. You control the population, you lead them into particular directions, the directions, whatever the agenda calls for. And I think the real answer to all of this is we are not asking the right questions. You ask the wrong question, and you get the right answer to the wrong question, and you never get anywhere. It's learning how to ask the right questions. You ask the right questions, you get the right answer, and it leads you to where you're talking about. It's got to go, it's got to, we're in a trickle-down effect right now where the problem is, problems are. We should be in a trickle-up effect. And if the consciousness or the mindset is that we can get along, that there is really no color, no gender difference, no whatever the case may be, ethnicity, etc., and that a human being is a human being, and we don't point a finger at them and saying, because of you, I didn't get this. That's one of the problems that we have. We are getting entitled, and then that entitlement takes us away from spirituality and the ability to think beyond the box that you're talking about. Right now, we are living in this country, it is a give-me world, and that's not the way it was set up.
I do agree with, because my conscious, my whole three books written in the principle of conscious reality creation mantra. And that mantra, I hope you would have got the book, but you didn't. You might get the book tomorrow. That whole principle, the mantra is that I create my own reality and I'm responsible for what I am. I'm master of my destiny, not victim of fate. And the secret lies in the principle is the responsibility. The more you take responsibility, more secrets will be revealed to you. The more you blame, the secrets which is given to you will be taken away from you. The whole secret lies in taking the responsibility. Unfortunately, we do not take the responsibility. We give, ask other people to take. We give the political, economic, and the religious, military leaders. They make the decision for us rather than we make the responsibility to take decision for us. And second mantra is for collectively. That mantra is for individually. And collectively, we, the members of global family, are responsible for what we are. And we are responsible for what we are. And we are master of our own destiny, not the victim of fate. On that basis, this is the principal mantra of 21st century, evolution of human consciousness. Because we, the major evolution is now happening. From the
let me hold you up for a minute, because I think that we're starting to run out of time, but this is a very important point. I totally 1,000% agree with what you're saying. I live in a country that I can think pretty much the way I want to think. And if I think that I want to step outside the box and think that way, I'm not concerned about somebody breaking through the door and coming in and killing me because I don't think that way. The idea here is to get the message to those people that live in the countries that they don't dare say anything like this in public. They don't dare think those thoughts because they'll get killed for it. I think the real key is to move in that direction, where if we want a global healing, if we want a global population, we all have to be able to move from the same page. We all have to have that safety and security within us to say, if I make that step, I'm not going to get hurt for doing so. And I think that's a lot of the problem that's going on right now. Because I believe everything you're saying, because in my world, that's believable. That's manageable. That's a realistic goal for me. But if you take it to a world that doesn't live the way I live, then it's not something believable, because it's frightening if they do think otherwise.
But here is the switch. Now we have to how to turn around. Let me give an example. I was born during the Gandhi era. Mahatma Gandhi started for the first decade of 20th century. He was by himself. And he came, thought outside the box, thinking we can get the independence and freedom from British rule by the principle of nonviolence. But that time there was not a big network, but he started experimenting it and created his word-of-mouth network. Now we are in the Facebook and everything, amazing internet, IT programs and internet programs. We create our network faster than that. That's what we are doing it right now. You are calling me for the interview and I'm answering you. So we have to create a network, and we will not be done tomorrow. If we start today, we'll be 10, 15 years, we can change the mindset for taking responsibility. By create model, we can create our. But we have to create network. That was your radio show. Is a part of the network. Yesterday, I gave another radio show called Universal Spiritual Community. There are also cases. So we are consciousness is awakening. They are not confined to organized religion. Now it's opening up the consciousness because we are open. The spiritual people are awakening. We are avoiding the word religion, because word religion came for realigning yourself. It came from the Latin word religio, realigning yourself to the divinity. And they use the religion for spirituality, this substitute the word for the spirituality. And now we are talking spirituality, the relationship with the you and me. We are all connected. We are sure. That was the principle. Is that Gandhi taught me the first lesson? We, the members of the global family, we are all children of divinity. And the goodness is that there is the principle of truth. The truth is that we are all children of the divinity. And the second is the goodness. We have to respectfully treat each other with love and care, breaking all the barriers of the caste, color, creed, and ethnicity. That is the goodness, truth, and goodness.
But we ran out of time, and I would like to speak to you longer. Let me ask you this. Is there a website we can find you at and purchase the series of books? And
yeah,
get
my
more
website is vipinmehta.com, and my Facebook is also there. And let me give my Facebook is facebook.com/authorvipinmehta.
By the way, thank you so much for joining us tonight, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much, Doctor.
Thank you. Good night.
You are. Bye.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Wow. Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Call us toll-free, 888-429-5471. That's 888-429-5471. Dr. James Anderson with us, MD. The Simple Diet. Lose up to 50 pounds in about 12 weeks. A doctor's science-based plan. No rigid rules, no strict menus, no measuring, no counting, or expensive meal plans. He's published more than 350 scientific journals and founded the Obesity Research Network. And let us say, hi, James, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, there's so much information out there about diets and you know, how to lose weight and go to the gym or eat this or do that. But when it really comes down to it, James, is there I'm going to call it a magic. Is there a certain something that most people are missing and they're not hitting the mark to get what they want out of that weight problem that they have?
Okay. I think basically two items to make it extremely simple is people need to eat more fruits and vegetables to be fill up on the more high-fiber fruits and vegetables. And secondly, they need to become fat detectives. They need to avoid excessive fat, particularly from animal and dairy products. But it goes at that by asking them to, you know, during the initial phase, they have five meal replacements a day. So they get their nutrition from three shakes and two entrees a day, two frozen food entrees a day. And that gives them the basic nutrition. They drink lots of water, and they eat five servings of fruit or vegetables a day.
Now, by the way, those fruits or vegetables, what effect do they have on the body? What actually occurs to the body when someone eats the fruits and vegetables?
Basically, fruits and vegetables are very filling. You know, they only have, many of them only have 15 to 20 calories per ounce, you know, whereas steak has 120, has 10 times that many calories per ounce. So basically, the average American only eats about three or four servings of fruits and vegetables a day, less than half of the recommended amount. So eating more fruits and vegetables will give people more filling, more bulk. And, you know, getting in fluid and bulk is very important. You know, the stomach can't tell the difference whether you drink water or Coca-Cola. All it wants is to be full. Later, you know, on down the intestine, it detects the sugar and so forth in the food, but the stomach just wants to be full. And so keeping your stomach full is an important task in weight loss, I think. Very important.
Now, let me ask you this, and I know that that if people are taking certain vitamins, I'm not a clinician, but I know that if people are taking certain vitamins, you know, people will take a multivitamin every day, and they'll maybe take some B12 to, you know, amp up the red blood cells and so on and so forth. But our bodies are so completely different, and the thought has always struck me about diet and food that, let's say, for instance, that I'm going to give you the example. It's not exactly spot on because, again, I'm not a clinician, but let's say that you want to beef up your red blood cells, so you're taking vitamin B12, and for some reason it's not working. But so you have to take something else to cause the vitamin B12 to do the job and go into the bloodstream instead of the skin. Now, we're all different that way because we're built the same, but to different degrees, the body needs certain things to connect for what it does. Is it the same thing with diet? If I got on a diet, the same diet as someone else, would we both have the same effect? Is a diet tailored to the individual personality? I guess that's really the question.
Okay, basically, I think we found a diet seems to fit all. And so basically I've treated about 1,500 people with this diet. And when people follow the diet, they do very well. My book came out 2 months ago. And people are reporting more weight loss on my diet than on the simple diet than they did in our research study. So basically, wow. People are doing this. So I think that you're right. You know, from my dad, I inherited, he was very obese. I inherited a need for lots of volume. I inherited a need for lots of sweets and also for seasoning. And many people have that. Now, simple diet meets the volume, and with fruits and vegetables meets the sweetness that people need. But you know, not one diet does not fit all. But I think that we found that people who follow this diet will systematically lose weight, and most people can follow this diet. It's once they get down towards their goal weight, then they can transition to a diet that meets their more specific needs. You know, the volume is too much in our diet. I have a 300-pound attorney. He tells me this is too much to eat. He has trouble eating it. Well, that's kind of good, you know?
Sure.
So, I mean, basically, I think that, you know, for lifetime living, people do need to tailor the diet to meet their needs. But a major goal is to learn to become fat detectives and eat less fat. You know, fat is the, like my learned Harvard professor said, you know, it's the fat, stupid. it's the fat we eat that's our major contributor to our obesity.
Okay, now calories are how important are calories? Can you burn calories off? I'm an old bodybuilder. I've been probably working out for 50 years now, and one of the things I learned, and please stop me if I'm wrong here, you take in you're a certain body. I happen to be 5'8", weigh about 160 pounds average, give or take a couple of pounds either way, and that's pretty much standard for me. And if I eat a certain amount of calories and I don't exercise a certain amount, I'm going to gain some weight if I don't burn them off.
Right.
Or if I eat a certain amount, then I burn more than I've eaten off, I lose weight. Does that still apply?
Yes, it does. Basically, we ask everybody, basically, you can lose weight without exercise. But our diet, the phase one, teaches you to eat healthily, and it trains you for healthy living for life. And so basically, when you're in intense phase, we recommend that everybody develop an exercise pattern. I, like you, I go to the gym 4 or 5 days a week, and basically I think fitness, aerobic fitness, physical fitness through walking, and weight training or stretching are very important elements of a comprehensive healthy program.
Sure.
You know, but it's hard to, you know, to, I burn about 500 calories a day in exercise. You know, but if I do that and don't watch my diet, I still gain weight. So I think everybody needs to build exercise into their diet. One of the problems is when people lose weight, their metabolism goes down. They don't require as many calories per pound as before they lost. If they lost 50 pounds, they require less calories per pound than they did when they were 250 pounds. You know, so it needs to be tailored. But this diet has worked very well in my experience, and I've treated 15,000 people over 30 years. And
sure.
This we've been fine-tuning this diet for the last 15 years, and it works extraordinarily well. We have 250 people who've lost over 100 pounds on a diet, and we just have people who are sustaining those losses long-term. So I think it is a good, healthy way. You know, the 5 fruits and vegetables is very important for health. You know, David Heber talks about what colors your diet, getting a variety of phytonutrients, protective phytonutrients from fruits and vegetables. I think that's very important. That's something that many Americans just don't do.
No. I think what's great also is I've got the book in front of me, starting on page 104, where it's got some of the weight exercises, and their weight exercises. You got a young woman doing this, and their weight exercises that anybody can do. Simple as a weight.
Right,
and
that's right.
Yeah. And
right.
It's not
this thing young that you veterinary student. That I took these photographs. She was a research assistant with me before she went to veterinary school. And I said, we need to be able to show people exactly what to do, and they should be able to do this at home.
Yeah. No, absolutely. No, and these are easy enough that anybody can do these. And I can imagine if somebody is really overweight, there's got to be Oh, a modified way of doing this also. One of the things that I, you know, learned over the years, if you can't do a push-up, if you can't get on the ground and do a push-up, you can stand by a couch or a chair and push up off that. So there was a way to do all
of it.
That's
right, you can do a wall push-up. Right, that's right.
No, absolutely. There's a way to do it all, and I really believe if somebody really wants to do it, they can do it.
Right.
But the one thing that they have to have is they have to have somebody for a while holding their hand. And the other thing that is extremely important, James, we're talking about a support group. Now, let me ask you this. On your website,
right,
and I haven't been there, is there support? Is there something, you know, once somebody's got the book, is there some place that someone can go, maybe a weekly Q&A or something along those lines?
We're providing that through Facebook and through our website. Basically, we don't have we haven't refurbished our website to have people post comments, but people have been posting comments on Amazon.com and on Facebook, and then also on my blog. So we have I'm systematically answering questions, and our readers are appreciating that. I've been answering most of your questions within 24 hours. So we do have that, and my dietitian associate, Nancy Gustafson, also is doing that. So we do have, you know, we haven't been overwhelmed, and so we are, I have a blog posted, common questions about the simple diet, and so they can access that by going to simplediet.com. Our website is AndersonSimpleDiet.com. You go there, and that takes you every place you need to go. It takes you to my Facebook page, where you can post questions. I'll answer them. It'll take you to my blog, where you can post questions, comments, and I'll answer that. So we're doing that systematically, and readers are appreciating that.
Wonderful. James, we're just about out of time. You've given us the website. I want to thank you so much for the time you spent with us, because I truly believe in today's world with the, I'm going to use the O word, with all that obesity out there that doesn't have to be there, people need a tremendous amount of help to get rid of it, and also the incentive to do so.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Hey, by the way, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I appreciate your interview, and I think you covered the ground very well.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
Young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Call us toll-free, 888-429-5471. Friar Alan Phillips is with us, and he is the author of From Blues to Smiles to Joy. Have a great day. Every day, he's a Catholic priest and a member of the Passionate Religious Congregation. He received his Master's of Divinity degree from St. Menard School of Theology in Menard, Indiana, and has pursued further theological studies at the Catholic Theological Union in Chicago, and he is a member of ACT, the Association of Christian Therapists. Alan, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Oh, thank you so much. Let me tell you what I learned about the Catholic religion probably 35 years ago, I had a friend of mine years and years back who had a went to school and got a doctorate in theology. And he had gone to Spain and Portugal and those in those countries. And he learned something very interesting as he was doing his research. The psychiatric beds in those countries, which were predominantly Catholic, were fewer than the rest of Europe. And what he found was it was the confession. And that in and of itself, allowing people to get rid of what they were holding on to, allowed them not to internalize it and get to a point where they couldn't deal with it and, you know, onto the psychiatrist and so on and so forth. So that in and of itself, I thought was absolutely brilliant.
That's very affirming, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, what was it that caused you to put this information to pen?
Initially, I was concerned about young people who were thinking about suicide or attempting it. I wanted to open their eyes to the beauty of human life and help them find hope. But then the more I wrote, the more I realized this applies to just about everybody, the general public. So
sure.
The book is generally addressed to people who are just feeling down.
You know what I found out about suicide, again, many years ago? It's many years ago. I've been around for a while. But what I did find out is this, and it seemed like it was an overarching theme from those people that were left after suicide, was it was a permanent solution to a temporary problem that just couldn't get an answer. And a lot of that answer is just the ability to be alive and have it okay to be themselves and wake up and have a great day every day. And a great day doesn't mean that you're up and smiling and screaming and yelling and having the greatest time in the world. You can be happy if you're in tears.
One of the things I try to assure people that there's no stigma to being depressed, that they're actually in good company. Abraham Lincoln, Winston Churchill, Princess Diana, Mother Teresa, they all had battles with depression, but they were able to accomplish a lot and still enjoy life.
So yeah.
Encouraging the whole famous people have dealt with this.
Also, Alan, I think one of the things that people don't know, is the definition of, and I don't have a definition for anybody else but me, but the definition of what happiness is. If you don't know what to look for, if you don't recognize it within yourself, how are you going to experience it? I think it's a major problem. And there's so many people that are, I think if we broke down depression, depressing, bringing down, hiding something that you're not or don't have the ability to face at the time. And I think that's a lot of it also. Go back to the hospital beds that, you know, weren't filled up in the psychiatric wards. It was if you stuff enough and you can't deal with all of it at one time, you're going to hide. And where do you hide? You hide within yourself.
Yeah. I think sometimes people talk to themselves negatively, a negative self-talk, and they put themselves down, consider themselves a failure, and blame themselves, and don't realize they've really accomplished a lot so far. They've got a lot of talent to offer. Their life has got a lot to give them. Just get over this hump.
Yeah, yeah. And I think a lot of what I've seen also, too, there are a lot of people who have, they don't have the acceptance from family, from the environment, from whatever. And if you're not accepted and you feel like you're alone and you don't have, quote unquote, an identity that comes from acceptance, depression is a really good place to hide. And there are people who get a lot of attention for being depressed and being sick, because if they're not sick or depressed, nobody's going to talk about them. So there's kind of a lot of angles to look at this from.
Yeah. I think the key thing is to talk to somebody who really cares.
So
you don't feel like you're facing it alone. Somebody gives you the gift of their attention. Then you feel, I'm worthwhile. They're actually paying attention to me. And maybe I can trust them with some of the negative stuff about me. They're not going to put me down. Oh, it feels good. I can tell them some more stuff. And all of a sudden, they get a chance to look at it objectively and say, hey, I'm going to get through this. It's okay.
Yeah.
I'm okay.
but by the way, and it's giving themselves permission to be okay. I think that's the key. We look to so many other people for their permission to be happy, to do this, to do that. And realistically, we begin to forget about ourselves. And when you do that, your entire world, whatever you do, is diluted, because it's not coming from your definition of life. It's coming from someone else's definition of life.
Yeah. I find one of the things I try to encourage people to do is just to forget about themselves for the time being and try to get out and cheer somebody else up. In the very process, they feel better themselves. Oh, here's somebody else who's looking sad. I can make them happy. Oh, I feel happy too. Hey, both of us benefit. Win-win.
There is one way. You know, there's a surefire way of getting out of depression. It works every time. Go run. Go exercise. Go get yourself in such a sweat that you didn't think that you could, you know, you could put yourself out that much physically. And I'll tell you what, all those emotions start to fly in. They go away. But most people don't do that. They sit and they stew and they brood, and that brings it on even more and more.
This is the first chapter in my book. I go out and talk about the basics. I ask people, do they exercise? Are they eating balanced meals? Are they getting enough sleep? Do they play? And, of course, in the Midwest, do you get enough light, sunshine? And some people say, well, I'll get to exercise sometime, or I'm too busy to sleep, or whatever it might be, can't take time to play. They're going to feel down. Our emotions follow our body. If we care of our body, emotions are going to be much more in balance, too. Exercise is key.
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, there was a time, I'll make it short, but there was a time in my life, I had horses for years and years and years, and there was a particular horse that when my horse, you go to saddle him, it was called cinch bound, he would go up, over, and down, and he put a fear into me. I got to a point where I got afraid of the horse, and there was a trainer who lived maybe a quarter of a mile away from me, and I used to take him over to her place, and we'd put him in what's called a round pen. You'd stand in the middle, and you'd have a rope on the horse, and you'd chase him with a little whip. And she'd get me to chase that horse, and I'd chase that horse, and I would run. And by the time I was done, I was so sweating and out of breath, who had time to be afraid anymore? And I think that's really what it is. Find another way, a healthy way, to get rid of it.
And chances are you're going to sleep better that night, too, because you're all worn out.
You bet I did. Yeah. Absolutely. So there's got to be those ways. And the youngsters today. You know, there was a time when you could speak the same language. I think it's got to be tough to speak to some of the kids today. They speak a completely different language than older people do. Not that it's good or bad or indifferent, but they've got a different set of values, a different set of wants and desires and of what they think is right, quote unquote. And I think the biggest problem that parents have today is their ability to speak to those kids in a way that they understand, to bond, to be able to work something out together.
Well, the kids are getting bombarded with commercials that tell them you got to have stuff to be happy. And I think the parents need to tell them, folks, you don't need that to be happy. It's just those things help us get through life, but happiness is a deeper thing than just having a lot of stuff.
Sure. By the way, I get depressed. I'll sit there and turn the TV on, and the first thing that I get are zombies or werewolves or vampires. I don't get any of this anymore. Goodness.
I don't watch too much of the news. The news gets me depressed. I got to watch it for a little bit, and that's it.
Yeah, yeah. Same thing, zombies, vampires, and werewolves. But, but when you really come down to it, with especially today, there's so much, there's such a myriad of media confusion, and what they've done, they've blurred the news over into entertainment. And because of that, there are a lot of people getting the wrong messages, and a lot of people who are unhappy that it's not necessary that they be unhappy. They got to be able to move through it.
One thing that cheers me up, we have the Rose Parade out here every year. The day after, they have viewing of the floats. And there's 100,000 people that come look at the floats up close. I'm there with my camera because I love to take pictures. But I just, by being with 100,000 nice people, kids on dad's shoulders, people in wheelchairs, pardon me, excuse me, oh, ooh, and on together, the news media is never there. They show all the bad stuff that night, but there was 100,000 nice, ordinary people having a good time, and it was a happy occasion, and you know, there's beauty in life, but the news doesn't show us that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, people, and you as a Catholic priest, you know, people today are starting to look at religion differently. And I think because of that, they stray away from their home, they stray away from the things that they were taught, and they stray away from the churches and the synagogues and so on and so forth. And how do you see that today as a priest? How do you see religion? And by the way, it's the same thing with the country. Say USA, 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 and you can't say it in a basketball game because you're teasing somebody else about it. We're very restricted. What's going on today? Do you feel as a priest that your hands are tied?
In many ways, how to be politically correct and yet still be truthful. And I'm up the age, I don't really care what people think. I try to tell them what I think is true, beautiful, good, and affirm them no matter what might be the politically correct thing to say. Yeah. Mainly, I think people need to feel that they're not facing life alone, that God who created them loves them, that forgiveness is possible, and life after death is possible.
Sure.
Eventually, you've got to deal with death, and that's where I come in and say, hey, this is not the final word here. Let's prepare ourselves for eternity. And I go through Scripture sometimes. It's just the positive things that Scripture says about sure. who people are, made in the image and likeness of God, a temple of the Holy Spirit, loved by God. And people don't sometimes realize how good they are and how blessed
yeah.
they are. And just counting their blessings from faith, counting their blessings from their family, their friends, the blessings of nature that are around us, the more grateful we are, the more we smile.
And think about this. Yeah, and think about this. If you take a child, that child is born totally neutral. There aren't any judgments. There's no hate. There's no whatever. It's just a baby, right? And the baby begins to learn. And if there's problems with kids today, that's our fault. That's our fault as the adults, what we've allowed them to model themselves after. It's not so much what you literally teach them, but it's what's modeled in school. Look at the dropout rates and the things that are going on today. And we're moving away from, who we are. I was brought up in this country with a Judeo-Christian ethic, and I still have that today, and I don't care what anybody does to bring it in to try to change that. That's not who we are, and that's not where we were built. And with this political correctness thing, they're killing themselves.
Yeah, I think the prejudice is something we learn, not given to us by birth.
Sure.
And, we need to unlearn it. And prejudice against ourselves, that I'm not worthy, or I'm not good, or I'm not talented, or I'm not like so-and-so. Negative self-talk is just gets us no place. And parents, teachers, priests need to affirm the talents people have, the good things they've done, possibilities that life holds out for them, and how to cooperate and get along with other people, because they also have talents and goodness in them that we can work together as a team and make this life better.
Sure, but see, I think people like yourself now have a much tougher job. And when I say a much tougher job, I remember when I was a kid, we didn't lock the houses. You didn't lock your car. I don't remember anybody as a kid having a gun. My goodness, anybody being shot? What is that about? We thought we were tough guys, but the worst thing we got into was mischief more than anything else. And so it wasn't like it is today. And, the job that you have today, I think, is 10 times harder than the job that another priest would have 10, 15 years ago.
And the problem is there's less of us to go around, too. So we're trying to stretch ourselves and be as available to people as possible and just help them realize there's hope of help and hope around for them.
And there is. And if people would just open up and start to listen, what we are is we're frightened. And if we're frightened, we're moved in certain directions. Look at what goes on in the news constantly every day. You're going to lose this. You're going to lose that. You're going to lose this. You're not going to get that. But if you do this, we'll give you this, 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 and that. So we have gotten into a place where people are frightened to death to say, I believe. Look at all the different, look at what they're doing when they're taking God out of everything. I happen to be Jewish, not choking on being Jewish, but I'm joking. I was brought up, we had Christmas trees, we sang Christmas carols, we exchanged gifts, we did all of those things, and my feeling about it is this, that the culture is being attacked, and as the culture is being attacked, more books like yours have to get out so people can read them. Don't take my culture away. That's the key. And that's what we were brought up with, and it's not fair that anybody should take it away. That's why you find now in all this depression going on and all of these people who don't trust everybody, it's because they're frightened. They're more frightened today than they were ever in this country.
That's why I think we take the time to listen to each other. We're going to find that there's a person who's got a lot in common with me, and we're closer than I thought we were, and the differences should not be a barrier. I like the story of Groucho Marx. I don't know if you remember this one. He was trying to get into a fancy country club, and somebody told him, they couldn't go into the pool because he was Jewish. And Groucho says, "My daughter's only half Jewish. Can she go in up to her waist?" Love it. It just made prejudice look so stupid.
Oh, absolutely. And I think when you really come down to it, this everybody's waiting to sue somebody today. And I really believe I was in the service years and years ago. And I remember the one thing that I did learn, I was in the Marine Corps, that if, and I thank God, knock on wood, I didn't have to see combat. It was, you know, before Nam and after Korea, right in that period where there wasn't a war. But I was taught this, and it's true. If you're in a combat situation and there's somebody at your back, you don't care if it's a man or if it's a woman, what their, you know, what their ethnicity is, their color is, their whatever. And they're there to be at your back. And I think that's one of the things that we're starting to lose today.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's called, people are crying out, help me, protect me. But they're frightened to death if they say it out loud, what's going to happen to them.
If I need a blood transfusion, I don't care what country, what nationality, I need to be positive.
You bet. That's a loud and clear. Alan, we're starting to run out of time. A quick funny before we go. Okay. All of my friends when I grew up, everyone I was close to was Italian and Catholic. And when we were in car clubs in those days, in the 50s, and we were in car clubs in those days, and when it would come to be Thanksgiving or something, we'd go house to house and we'd collect cans for the needy and whatever. And we would get over to the church and we'd be standing there in line and the father would say, you know, Nick, I'll see you in church Sunday. Chuck, I'll see you in church. Gary, I'll see you in church. Hello, Michael. The good old days. Okay, but, do you have a website we can find you with a book at?
Yes, BluesToSmiles.com. Very appropriately, BluesToSmiles.com.
Wonderful. We're about running out of time. Alan, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Take care. Good night.
Okay, have a good night. Bye-bye.
Off comes the makeup. Off comes the clown's disguise. The curtain's fallen. The music softly dies. But I hope you're smiling as you're filing out.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser.
And I'm Radio Susie.
And that, my friends, is a wrap.
In this biz, that's all there is. There isn't any more.
Oh, that's right.
We've shared the moment.